Welcome back to Silver Screen Social, listeners. I'm your host, Jackson Vickery, and on this episode, I spoke to the composer and the music supervisor about their work on the new look.
Parisian couture could influence how thousands of ordinary women dream and live. But fashion needs a new leader. A figurehead. Monsieur Dior. I keep looking for a great collection to rise from the ashes of the war. Monsieur Dior, what do you desire?
To design the most beautiful women's clothing that ever existed.
Christian Dior ruined French couture, and I'm coming back to save it.
For those of us who lived through the chaos of war, creation was survival.
The legend of Coco Chanel. If people only knew.
If I keep on giving them lips that can kill, they gonna have to come and arrest me.
Chanel can be very treacherous.
Oh, yes. My heart
is... Are you happy with the revolution you started?
There is the truth. My mind is... But there is always another truth that lives behind it.
Your sister, she's not safe.
Creation cannot stop the bullet, but creation is our way forward.
Our choices matter. I am
Your house will be magnificent.
You think Dior is fashion?
Real talent is turning your life into something bigger.
People need to feel, dream, they need to live again. We can create a new world for them.
So nice meeting you two. As I was just telling James, I went into this show completely sort of without knowing anything except for probably seeing a poster and a teaser trailer. And boy, was I quickly informed that it was not going to be as fashion focused as I thought it was going to be. And it went into a direction that has absolutely just been transfixing. And I have to take the show in very small doses now because of that, because I did not, or I was not familiar with the subject matter or just with these sort of two iconic figures being so integral to such an important part of world history. So, I am just, I have to say thank you so much. And I mean, what a project to be a part of.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's funny because there were actually two trailers. I'm not going to give too much like on this, but there were two trailers originally that were being batted around. One was more centric, historical centric, and one was more fashion centric. And in the following October 7th, this fall, Apple was like, we need to lead towards the fashion end of things. And like, let's lighten up on the history things. And it was like, it was a discussion that was had, and it was interesting. And because we knew, you know, having worked on the show, like, you know, the historical thing is really the meat and potatoes. The fashion is like this beautiful thread, narrative thread through it in a way, no pun intended, but for me, being a history, I love history. I'm a history kind of nerd. And so it was a pleasure in that regard to be able to be a part of it and to help, you know, to have to do the research to make sure we're accurate, at least my part of it with music and songs, you know, that was complicated. It required a lot of research, but I relished it. So, and it was heavy. Mm-hmm. It was definitely heavy too, as you said.
Yeah, it's funny. I I've been out of town. I was with Mark in New York for the premiere last week, and then I stayed on the East Coast for a while. But I was in with one of my assistants who actually she's like the singer on the score, and she's also plays all the violins and violas on the score. We were together today in the studio, and I'm like, "What are your friends saying?" She's like, "My friends are like, no one had any idea, like exactly like what you're saying. No one had any clue. Like they thought it was going to be like Capote and the Swans a little bit, you know, a little bit corny and kind of, you know, whatever. But no one really, like, people are getting a little bit sort of blindsided by like not only by the history, obviously by the show, and but it's heavy, you know. And so it's kind of interesting. In many ways, I think I know, like, when I first heard all this stuff and learned all this stuff and researched, I was as shocked as you are, but I've sort of been, not jaded, but I'm just so familiar with it at this point and lived with it for so long as we were working on it, that I sort of took it for granted, you know, how shocking this is going to be for many, many people. And I think, you know, it's interesting. A lot of people still can't believe it. You know, if you read articles about it, people are like, what? Yeah. Oh, there's no way. And it's the more you get into the history, it's real, like the stuff. It's worse than what you even see.
Yeah, I definitely felt like I was aware that particularly the Chanel storyline was going to open a lot of people's eyes. Mm-hmm. You know, even Bill Burr, if you follow him, he did like a whole bit. He did a whole bit on this piece of history in his Red Rocks performance, and I was like, oh my god, like, it's coming out. That was like 2 years ago, I think. That's still a portion of the TV watching audience, you know. So.
Mm. And I'm curious why this story and why now? Obviously, like you were saying earlier, I mean, October 7th kind of put a different type of perspective on this show, but I'm curious, I mean, like you said, you've been on the show for much longer than that. So I'm curious when it came to the producers and why did they want to tell this particular story?
Well, Adam, you know, had a few connections to it. So, I mean, he had a few projects in mind when he was developing this in the beginning. But, you know, I think there wasn't a necessarily it had to be now when he was cracking these scripts 3 years ago. It wasn't like, a lead up to some anniversary necessarily. There were some personal connections that he made to Dior's life story, to a close friend of his who passed away. And I think there was similarities in their life stories that once he learned more about Dior and his life, that really kind of felt like, to him, like, I need to tell this story. So I don't know if it was necessarily a lead up to a specific date, like right now or anything like that. Yeah, I mean, so.
Just to echo Mark, it was, there was, I know, in speaking with Adam, you know, he had a very close friend who, as Mark said, had passed away, and whose life trajectory somewhat mirrored that, as an artist, somewhat mirrored that of Dior's. And he had been looking for a way to kind of honor his friend with some kind of story or some work of art, some sort of just anything, just because he felt it was important. And he was actually in like a Dior boutique. Did you hear this, Mark?
Maybe.
He was like sitting with his, you know, then wife and in a Dior boutique, and he just like was sitting there and picked up the book and sort of started learning about Dior, more about the life portion, and sort of was like, oh, that's interesting. Like, and then he kind of dug a little deeper, and when he started pulling the layers back, he learned about, you know, Coco. But there was no like timing thing about, oh, it's got to be now. I mean, it was more just art, survival, the age of, you know, Dior. It was just a fascinating historical, you know, piece that really most of us don't even know about when you look at the labels that people wear, you know, or shop for, revere in fashion. You know, you don't think of, you know, what their stories, what's the, you know, what's the grizzle down there, you know,
yeah.
Where's the funk, you know?
Yeah. And historically, you know, art is always such an amazing way to learn about history and learn about culture and learn about, you know, movements and origins of movements. And it's, yeah, I've always found that. It's one of the appeals for me of being in music and appreciating mm-hmm. art in different ways.
Yeah.
And so what did the research process look like for you two individually? And then where did you two first sort of cross your paths in this project?
I mean, Jimmy and I always have stayed in touch over the years, whether we're working together or not. But if something comes up, you know, we kind of start to connect on things. And so I'd been already started working on the show with Adam and talking about musical ideas. And so we were testing out some concepts of, you know, like songs at the end, and perhaps like maybe we could do an original song. What would that look like? What would the song be? And then Adam had the idea of, you know, grabbing the melody from that song and maybe weaving it into the score of that episode, which I thought was a super cool idea. Obviously, licensing wise, it presented a whole array of challenges, but I was like, that's a really cool. But then at the time we were like, not quite sure, like the composer thing was a little in the discovery process, but I was, you know, immediately thinking of Jimmy because I knew some of the work that he had done recently. Actually, he shared a lot of great work he had done recently that I thought was in the direction where we could go. We were talking to Jack Antonoff at the time. You know, what his role could be. Was it a composer? Was he going to be a music producer? I was leaning towards the latter and Adam was too. It's a big show. Like, let's go with someone who's experienced, who we possibly have already worked with. And I was like, this guy. So, yeah, through conversations, that's when, you know, we started talking and bringing Jimmy into that. And Jimmy had, again, presented such a great array of music that I thought was great for temp. So kind of got that to the editors and then started talking with Adam, the three of us. Jimmy, you can maybe speak to me.
Yeah, I mean, like Mark said, we've worked together with Adam, you know, since Damages, so it's like almost 20 years, which is wild. So we've all become friends and check in now and then and stay in touch. For this project, sort of, Mark called me. I think it was like 2 years ago. You know.
Yeah, it was. It was two. Yeah.
There's this project, and he kind of talked about it. He said Adam's going to call you, so I spoke with Adam, and it seemed very intriguing. And then, but it was still early days. And of course, I was down to do it. It was like whenever I work with these guys, it sort of brings out some of the best stuff I've ever done. You know, I just know that now, having worked on enough stuff. And it's also like really hard work, which I love. And but it's super rewarding because everybody, it's a really open process. You know, there's no sort of wrong ideas, and it feels safe in that way as a composer. But yeah, so when the song thing came up, it was curious. Like I knew like ultimately, like I didn't want the score to sound anything like the song that Jack was doing. But we wanted to lay these breadcrumbs. So there was some sort of almost subconscious familiarity with the melody in the hook of the songs, so that by the time you heard it, it felt like a bit of a release at the end, because the subject matter, you know, as you can tell, is like pretty not surprising and heavy, and it's tense. And we wanted to like take these songs and kind of fracture them and fuck them up, so that, you know, they were songs that are normally played major, but I'm gonna find a way to make it minor and try to really like milk as much tension as I can out of the song without it feeling at all like what the song really is known as. And that was just a speaking to our relationship and like the process, just something I could experiment with pretty freely. And initially I kind of wanted to establish like instrumentation and tone. So I worked really hard on some themes that were more original to the show, like the original score, like stuff, and then find ways to break down my themes, like to fracture those and then insert parts of the song melodies so that they kind of are playing inside and outside and alongside one another. And the actual tune of this, you know, of the end song, which is also often the title of the episode or part of the title of the episode, so that there's a bit of a payoff, you know, emotionally for the viewer and for us, you know, it was, you know, for the people working on it. And that's how it kind of worked. It sounds like it is it's super deep and complex. Like it's kind of hard to get your head around it, I would imagine, like for you sitting there hearing it. And even when I'm describing it, I'm like, God, that sounds really crazy. But somehow.
It's like the magic of the creative process. And right. I think also the magic of the two of us having worked together for so long. I mean, mm-hmm. when we started talking about like the instrumentation ideas, it was like immediately we're like, fit, yeah, like that. It'd be like, oh, a little bit of this. And like, I mean, like, talking about some specific instruments, maybe a couple of references to other scores. Like we talked about the Phantom Thread, Johnny yeah. Greenwood. That was something we liked, like, even though that was super dark, but there was like some raw instrumentation in there we liked. But we were quick, again, because we've worked together for those years, we just were able to like get the ideas flowing. Then Jimmy just dove in and just masterfully started coming up with these really cool sounds right away. I was like, ah, yeah, that's it. Like Adam's going to love that. It was really cool when those sounds, you know, the sounds.
Yeah. I wrote a piece. The first piece I wrote was when the first bit of picture I saw was the first episode. And it's quite different from what it wound up being, obviously, because it was early days. But I remember watching it and it had no score and just kind of like immediately feeling like the ideas we had discussed were going to be right. And then so I spent like, I think like 3 weeks working on like a 9-minute long sort of suite piece for the end of the episode so that we could kind of just to explore the instrumentation that we had discussed, also to like explore newer ideas. It had no relationship to the song yet because we hadn't even like 100% pinned down what the songs were going to be. That was more of a, you know, that was something that we were going to get into, but I was like, I just want to do our music first and then figure out the song, because otherwise it was like I didn't at all want it. And I think Adam also and Mark, like you agreed, like he never, like the whole thing was like, don't, you're not doing the song, you're just using parts of the song. So I wanted to approach it like as our music, as the character's music, as the show's music first and foremost, and then go back and, you know, find ways to, you know, drop in little breadcrumbs, as you know, along the way. But yeah, I wrote this like 9-minute long piece and it was like, you know, it hit, you know, pretty hard right away. So it was good.
Mm. And I'm curious when it comes to creating the world of Dior versus the world of Chanel, how you differentiated the two, but then also sort of brought them together. Because I think that is so seamless throughout the whole project.
Right. Well, I had certain themes for each that were our themes, and I restricted sort of the musical vocabulary, both melodically and the instrumentation. So like, for example, high strings, piano, voice, generally are Catherine and Christian. Cello, lower woodwinds, and sort of more prepared piano were for Coco. And that's sort of like the general. And then specifically with respect to the songs, you know, outside of the themes that each of them had for different you know, parts of the story, we would kind of like break down these standards. You know, I don't know if you're familiar with like a lot of these old standards, which were show tunes or, you know, war songs, like jingoistic war songs. They follow a pretty specific like song form, like usually AABA, like two verses, a chorus, a verse, and then maybe an instrumental section, and then that's it. So we would start by like maybe seeing, oh, does like the A section work better for Christian when I was working on it? Or does it work better for Coco? And what happens if I invert the melody but put the B section here? And then sometimes it was as simple as like, we're only going to play the, if it's a four note phrase, I'm going to put the first two notes in Christian's instruments on Christian. I'm going to put the second two notes of the phrase as the, you know, call and response. That would be like the response. I'm going to do that on Coco, but I'm going to play it down an octave, like on low, you know, on bass clarinet. Or something. I mean, like, so that, like, really fracturing the music in a way that felt like it differentiated, but at the same time, like you're saying, kind of like weaves its way in and out. So you create this like thread of familiarity and tension, you know, and like continuity, which I think the show really like we craved, you know, from the score. That's kind of it. Mark?
I mean, kind of back to what you were saying, your question about research, what research went on. I didn't necessarily go set out to differentiate Coco and Dior with song. Lyrically, yes. But like there was times when I wanted songs to speak to either character's situation or that montage, or if even if we were playing music in the background where they were. So yeah, we tried to define music for Coco eventually. She was more refined music, where Dior was in a creative world, younger world, people were partying. You see the parties that he had, you know, so that opened up more because they were more underground. So I felt like he explored genres more. We were able to play with different artists, obviously mostly French. But when it came to Coco, I tried to keep it more refined. Obviously she was in the Ritz a lot. So we just, and that was another challenge we made, is we had to have is like a lot of the editors like to just temp music in a lot of times, and they forget that, like, what is the source of this music if it's not just us being creative, you know? Like everyone didn't have a gramophone in every restaurant, bar and hotel room, you know what I mean? It just didn't work that way. So we had to be kind of realistic. Are we going to be realistic here or not? And are we have live music? Live music was very common then. That was pretty much what music was. So we had to make those decisions. Like when we're in the hotel in Luzerne, is there a band in the corner? Do we see them or not? And when we were shooting, there's a lot of scripted music on camera, and we had to strip a lot of that out because we didn't have the budget to put together bands in every scene. So, you know, so we just took the creative license to have music that I thought would be playing off camera in another room, whether it be a piano or a quartet, you know. But even finding the right quartet to play in those moments was really hard. It was really challenging. And a recording that was plausible to sound live, or if it's coming from a gramophone, like, do we have to go ahead and record a bunch of live stuff? So there was a lot of challenges that were for very simple background things, you know. But it was really fun when we got to get into like Dior and his parties and stuff like that. We could really start experimenting and get past like the period where the Aryan laws, you know, during the war were very restrictive, you know. So what people could play or perform live was also very restrictive because the Nazis were very much against jazz and swing, bebop, anything like that. So it had to be sort of sanctioned by them if it were a swing band, for example. So like that first episode with the swing band playing in the Nazi ball, we approached it as that was the sanctioned Nazi swing band, which there was one called Charlie and His Orchestra, which was actually they were German players who performed at Nazi functions. And when they had lyrics, they would alter the lyrics. They would play standards, but alter the lyrics to include Aryan messages. But in this case of that first episode of Ball, we just had no vocals. We just had a band. But so there was a lot of quite a bit of research and like what would be playing in Maxime's if the Nazis were there. You know, you can't just play anything because they would, you know, Heinrich Himmler's there. He's not going to let everything be played, you know? So it's kind of interesting, you know, like where to place restrictions and when not. And obviously once the war ended, we could open up more. So it was fun researching what could go on after that. So.
And I mean, just in our final few minutes, I'm curious what you two hope that people take away from the show when it sort of has its, when the final episode drops and once it's fully out there in the world for people to see.
Jimmy, let's take that first.
I hope people, I hope people feel like they appreciate, you know, not only like the show, but the idea that you can, there's many ways to learn history and everything, every person, every, you know, every country, everybody has their story, you know, like the way it, you know, like Christian says, you know, at the end of the first episodes, you know, there are sides to every story, and they're not necessarily what you think, and they're not very pretty, and they can be sanitized over time, but they're really critical to really understanding our where we are today, you know, as much as they were then, you know, they're pretty important now, and you know, there's sort of a, I think there's like a universality to the story, even though it's about artists and fashion, it's about like musicians, as Mark was saying, painters, and anyway, yeah, I want people to be moved, you know, and to be touched and to remember, like even remember the music, remember the songs, remember the fashion, remember, because I think everybody that worked on this show found it at a time in their creative career. I know personally where, you know, post-COVID, post a lot of shit that's going on, and even in the midst of it, it was such a release for all of us. And I hope people feel that same sort of sense of discovery and relief that we all felt making it.
Yeah, well said. Well said. Yeah, I think of course I sort of jumped right to the very end of the series when you asked the question, with that final fashion show and with Jimmy's incredible piece of score over it, which is so like exhilarating. And I felt like, I feel like, you know, that is where something, you know, like an art like fashion was able to transport people through these really, really challenging times, and always give them, you know, and give them a sense of hope, like the little miniature fashion show that happens. That's where I think the fashion component of this story is so, so surprising. And I feel like the end, I think it leaves people with a sense of hope. And I feel like that's, and if you think about what Heinrich Himmler says in the beginning, in that dinner, he says, you know, what they were trying to do is take away dignity of the Jewish people and hope. And like the end of the show is just the opposite of that. Like hope is back, it's there, and it's sort of been thread through this fashion narrative. So I hope like people feel that at the end.
Absolutely. But I want to thank you two so much for chatting with me today. Such an outstanding series, and I can't wait until, I mean, I've gotten to see it all, but I can't wait until everyone else has that opportunity to unfold each layer as it comes, because it's really, really special.
Totally.
Thanks so much.
Really, yeah, thank you.